the Norwegian kroner stays steady, trading at 7.81 and 12 the other way round. Now we've got Alvin Stardust as our first guest of the week. So I'm going to start with some music, as he was then, with Shane Fenton. And let's see. Yes, let's make that call.
No time for the movie show, TV or the radio. You gotta write a symphony and a book of poetry. Tie them with a ribbon made of gold. Today is Cindy's birthday. No time for geometry, arithmetic or history. Gotta write a song from my heart and paint the greatest work of art. Tie them with a ribbon made of gold. Cindy's birthday. No movies, turn off the radio.
So in my quest to get to the people that made our lives that bit better with the music that we all grew up with, let's go straight away to what we all know now as Alvin Stardust. And Alvin, a very, very good day to you.
And morning to you too.
And of course, it is quite confusing because you were one of the very, very few people that were managed to successfully have two careers. Now,
well, yes, it was. I feel like I had about four or five.
Well, I mean, realistically, most people of a certain age will know of Shane Fenton, of course, and
yeah.
The Fentones.
Yeah.
And, of course, that particular song I was just playing then, I think was the highest that Shane Fenton got under that name, wasn't it?
Do you know, I can't remember. It was such a long time ago.
Right.
But one of the reasons that we got kind of took off was because the first thing we did wasn't make records, it was to do radio. And if you did BBC Radio in 1960, you were, you know, the listening figures to one program like Saturday Club or Easy Beat, it was 25 million.
Yes.
So, whereas nowadays you play to, you know, a few thousand or a few hundred thousand, or even Radio 1, Radio 2 play to, you know, maybe 2-3 million. In those days, if you did a radio show, you went out to 25 million in one hit. So overnight, you became a household name. And we just fell on our feet, because the first radio show we did, the musical director on the show was a guy called Tommy Sanderson. He was looking to manage one of these newfangled rock and roll groups. So he asked us if he could manage us, so we said yes. And so then, of course, we were on every week. So, because our manager was on the show, you know, so... And that gave us such a boost. We were then able to tour before we had a record deal. We were touring with Billy Fury and Marty Wilde and Joe Brown. I mean, it was a fabulous time for us.
Yes. Well, there are one or two things written on the internet which I want to always clear up when I speak with the people that obviously made the music. Because, for example, let me just ask first and foremost, did you actually go on stage in a pantomime at the age of four?
Well, my mum had a boarding house. We were like digs for the local theatre in Mansfield. So from when I was about 3 or 4 years old, I was surrounded by singers, actors, jugglers, dancers, you know, the whole thing. And, of course, every year there'd be a pantomime on. And, you know, I used to go and sit in the wings and watch the rehearsals and things like that. And then, of course, when the show started, I knew everybody's parts.
Yes.
So... And I think they were doing something called, I think it was Babes in the Wood or something like that. And the producer was staying at our house, and most of the company were as well. We had one of those big Victorian terraced houses, which, I mean, nowadays everyone would give their right arm for because they're worth a fortune. But in those days, no one could afford to keep them up, really. So my dad got it as a perk for his job. He was a salesman, and the job came with a car and a house. And it was one of these massive houses, so we had these attics at the top that would hold, I think we had like six girls used to sleep in one room, all in single beds. And the other side We had two or three, you know, single beds in there that people could sleep in. Then we had another five bedrooms.
Yes.
So we were surrounded by it all. And I think one year the guy said, why doesn't Bernard come on stage and be one of the babes in the wood just for, you know, for the odd matinee?
Yes.
So I did, and of course I suppose that was it, and I was bitten by the bug.
And of course I did pick up on the fact that if the address I have in front of me is correct, that you were born in Muswell Hill, well, that's the same as the Kinks, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, it was funny because all my family, my mum's and dad's family, were from the East End. So I'm the only one that talks like this. I'm the only one that says Bath. And bus. Everyone else talks this Bath and Bass, you know. So so my life was all revolved around all my mum's family, which was big, and my dad's family. And I used to love it there because they were all into kind of going up the pub and singing on a Saturday night and things. So, but at the end of the war, a few of them got kind of bombed. They were on the Isle of Dogs. So they all moved out to places like Clapton, Hackney, Stoke Newington, things like that, and Muswell Hill. So I was born in Muswell Hill Maternity Hospital.
That's a lovely link, that, into the musical, well, the ethers, really, isn't it? Now, what about your band? Because it is written that Shane Fenton and the Fentones, the band based their sound on that of the Shadows. Now, I can see bits of it, but I wouldn't have thought that was totally accurate. But will you please tell me?
I think it was just one of those things. You know, we were all fans of... all the music that was around, and most of it was an American. It was all American. I mean, I was listening to Buddy Holly and Elvis and people like that, and Eddie Cochran. You know, from right in the 50s, and you know, we were influenced by. I listened to blues. I used to listen to B.B. King and people like that, and Howlin' Wolf, and all the stuff that was coming from the States. But the bands that were breaking big on things like 6-5 Special and Oh Boy were Billy Fury, Cliff Richard, Adam Faith, you know, Marty Wilde, all that great section of it. They were the kind of the pioneers of British rock and roll, really.
Yeah.
So we tended to, although we would do, I mean, one of our biggest influences, fun enough, was Louis Prima.
Oh, right.
You know, and the King of the Swingers.
Yes.
Because he was this lounge act from Vegas that, you know, I mean, he was massive. Even if Sinatra was on, you know, in another kind of club, Louis Prima's place was packed.
I did actually
night.
See him in Vegas, and I know exactly what you're referring to, and I enjoyed immensely the work that he does.
Yeah, I mean, I recorded I Ain't Got Nobody, 5 Foot Two Eyes of Blue. The first song we ever recorded at Abbey Road was Louis Prima's version of 5 Foot Two Eyes of Blue.
Now, you're not going to believe this.
Yes.
Tell me what you think this is.
I believe you.
Well, here we go. Bop, you bop, everybody loves you bop, hey bop. You bop, rock bop, shoot, 5 foot two eyes of blue. Oh, what that 5 foot can do, has anybody seen? I bet you haven't heard that for a while.
Listen, we should be on the radio with links like this.
I thought you'd like that. I've got something else that I hope you like as well, which I've lined up. But let me just quickly play a little burst of this. Okay, so here we go. Now, there'll be lots and lots of people that really grew up with that, and obviously, somewhere along the line, you either got great advice or you saw it for yourself. But, I mean, I thought it was so clever to actually recreate yourself in the 70s.
Well, it was a fluke. I mean, I think most of the things in show business are kind of, you know, happen by chance, and you bump into somebody. I mean, come the end of the 60s, the kind of recording career of Shane Fenton, the Fentones had finished, and I had a little rock and roll trio, because there was not much work around, and I was just doing pubs and clubs, and I had a little Gibson guitar, old Gibson guitar. I had a bass player and a drummer, because it was three-piece, that's the cheapest way to work, three of you, and we were doing pubs and clubs, and literally I was being managed by Hal Carter, who was Billy Fury's tour manager originally. And come like the 1970, 71, 72, Hal was getting work from Marty Wilde, Joe Brown, Billy Fury, me, because we all cut our teeth together on the original Larry Parnes rock and roll tours. And And Hal had a friend called Peter Shelley, who was a record producer, and he just started producing and writing. He was just going to be with a brand new label called Magnet Records. And Pete Shelley was the only producer on there. And he'd written and recorded a song called Cuckoo. And he asked Marty if he fancied singing it. And Marty didn't like the idea. I think he asked Vince Seeger as well. He was asking all these early 60s people. No one wanted to do it. So Hal said, why don't you have a go, Shane? So I said, well, I don't know. What's it? Oh, is it going to cost me? And he said, nothing. So I said, well, I'm your man. So I did it, and it came out. And I just thought it would just fizzle out. But of course, it took off. And then I had to kind of come up with, once we got Top of the Pops, you know, lined up, I had to think of something to do. And everyone in that glam scene were wearing, like, pink suits or sequins and things like that, or, you know, yellow jackets. And I thought, you know, no one's doing a Gene Vincent. No one's wearing black leather and black leather gloves, you know.
Yes.
So I thought, and no one's doing that kind of Elvis, you know, the quiff and all that. So I quickly dyed my hair black, literally the day before we did the first Top of the Pops, and got some leathers and gloves and things, and went on. And that was it. And it kind of just, overnight, pop, here I am, new image, everything, hit record.
Absolutely lovely, and it's lovely to hear these sort of, well, it's almost like exploding myths at some time, because, you know, everybody just sees this star come onto the screen, and there's numbers of people think that that's all that person ever did and always will ever do, you know.
Well, I think, you know, as you go along, I mean, when I first, the first interest I ever had in music was definitely from the Saturday matinees, and it was Roy Rogers and Gene Autry. Because they were our heroes, they, you know, the cowboys, and but they played guitar and sang, and I didn't know it was country music. It was just, I thought it was pretty cool. I thought I won't be able to get a horse, and my mum won't let me have a gun, and if I start fighting, I'll get told off. So, but I could get a guitar, so that was my first thing. And when I got my first kind of proper guitar in when I was 12, and it was like. Two, three years later, in 1958, in fact, it's 50 years to this year, I got on the bus at Mansfield and went to Doncaster to see Buddy Holly and the Crickets. And I got backstage and I met them. And I took my guitar, and I think that's the only reason I got backstage, because nobody had guitars then. You know, like now you see them at the corner of the street with them on their shoulders. You never saw them in those days. And at the end of me seeing them, I actually sang Peggy Sue with Buddy and the Crickets in their dressing room on my little guitar.
Yeah.
And then they signed my guitar at the end of the, you know, in the time I've been. And I took it with me everywhere. So then I got it a bit later on in 1960. I went to see Eddie Cochran and Gene Vincent in Manchester, and they signed it. And then at East Ham Granada, I saw Chuck Berry and Bill Haley. They signed it. And then I worked with the Beatles. They signed it. I got Johnny Kidd to sign it. Dave Berry. All people I worked with along the way, plus Billy and Marty and Joe. And then in 63, the Beatles signed it, because we were on the same label anyway.
Yes.
Parlophone. And then late 63, the Stones signed it. So I've got all these autographs on my original first ever guitar. And it's kind of, it's just given me inspiration to want to do. I mean, all the things like on Jealous Mind, or the little hiccupy bits I do, they're all Buddy Holly orientated.
Well,
things like that, you know. It's, I think it's, you've got to use things that you've learnt and grow up with, and I'm not ashamed to say I borrow all my idols.
I think you're answering the question I was going to put to you. Let me just quickly play a little bit of this. Here we go.
Okay.
Track again, was it last week in actual fact, and it's a lovely track.
It was, I mean, I was so lucky to because the 70s kind of came and went, and I had about six, about eight tracks out that were kind of number one or top three in about 9 or 10 territories around the world. Because obviously everything doesn't revolve around the UK. You know, with territories around the world like Germany and Benelux, it's about three times the amount of record sales. That's just across the water, you know.
Yes.
From the UK, but so you get, it's important to sell everywhere. But then the end of the 70s came, and I thought, well, I've had a really good crack of the whip. I can't really, you know, complain if it all fizzles out now. And then in 1981, I bumped into Mike Batt, who'd been a friend since the Wombles days, and he'd had a big hit with Art Garfunkel and Bright Eyes and Dave Essex, Winter's Tale and The Railway Hotel and things like that. I just said to him, you've never written me a song. And he said, all right, I will. And he wrote me I Feel Like Buddy Holly, and I nearly died. It was just, we didn't think that we'd get a record deal. You know, first of all, because it was the first time I'd ever done a ballad. And bear in mind, just before that, I'd come off of... in 1981, I bumped into... actually, Pete Waterman rang me. He used to be a plugger at Magnet Records, and Pete's always had great ears for hits. And he said, I've got this song, it's a number one, let's do it. I said, what is it? He said, it's a song called Pretend, it's an old Nat King Cole song. He said, the thing is, I said, but we'll never get a deal because... You know, this is 1981, and things have, you know, 70s are gone, you know. And he said, we'll get a deal. And it cost us 500 quid to record it, and people were spending 20 grand to make their singles. And we did it really quick in a little studio, took it to Stiff Records, of all places. Elvis Costello, Nick Lowe and all them. We got a deal, and Pretend came out, went to number one all over the place. And that gave us the shot. For later on, when I bumped into Mike Batt, and he did a ballad for me, because we already had a couple of charts in the successes in the 80s, and when we recorded "Feel Like Buddy Holly," I mean, it was a turntable hit. You know, all the jocks were playing it and everything.
I love that song. It's a lovely song.
Mike is such a clever guy. I mean, well, now he's doing all the Caetamillo songs and all her albums and things. I'm still writing stuff for them. Berlin Philharmonic and all that. Very clever guy.
I want to ask you about the UK tour of Godspell, because you played Uriah Heep, didn't you, in David Copperfield, the musical?
I did, yeah. Godspell was the first musical I did, and that was 20 years ago this year. The reason I know is because it was a leap year, and I met my wife on the 29th of February, and Jules was in the show with me, and we just met on that first day, and we've never been apart since. So, I remember Godspell very, very well. And, of course, I'd seen it with Dave Essex in the first time around.
Yes. And you also played Sir Billy Bowen, didn't you?
I did, yeah. I was right out of the blue. Someone came on and asked me if I'd do that. And I went to Butlins when I was a kid, and I still do gigs there. It's some of the best gigs in the world at Butlins now. And of course, I researched it, and he was quite a character. And I suddenly thought, wow, what a fabulous idea for a musical. And we did it just two nights. I know, one night at the Palladium, just as a celebration of the 60 years of Butlins. And the Palladium holds about, what, 3,500 people, say. So they put the word out that tickets would be available. They had 140,000 applications for tickets.
Wow.
So, you know, afterwards I said, you know, you should put this on the road as a musical, because this is a great idea.
And also, I'm looking sort of fairly recently, really, 2005, you were in Chitty Chitty Bang Bang.
Yeah, well, I was doing Phantom, and the producers of Chitty came in at the end of the show one night, and we had a drink in the bar, and I've known him for years, Michael Rose, and he said, I didn't realise you were doing theatre like this, and I said, well, yeah, I'm having a go, and he said, no, I'm really impressed. He said, will you do the Child Catcher for me? And I said, no, come on, Michael, you're winding me up, because everyone wanted that part. It was such a great part for the West End. And he said, no, I'm serious. I said, well, if you are, I'll do it. And I did it, and it was absolutely amazing. Absolutely amazing.
Do you think
great part.
Was there anything possibly connected with the fact that you were part of the Green Cross Code that was in, a long time ago, wasn't it, the Green Cross Code that you were in?
No, No, I think it was just... I mean, the Green Cross Code thing was just one of those one-off things. It was. I remember at the time, the government department for information was looking for a couple of people that youngsters would listen to. So they picked the biggest-selling record star at the time, and it seems bizarre to think about it now, but that year, I sold more singles than anyone else in the UK, including Elton John and Rod and all the other lot, you know. It was just a fluke. And so they picked me to do it. If they'd waited a bit longer, they'd probably pick Noddy Holder or something like that. But and they thought they'd go for the biggest high-profile football player, so they picked Kevin Keegan. And they got a great, you know, the best director and the best script writer, and we went in and we did all these Green Cross Code ads, and then 30 years later, a couple of years ago, mine was voted as the worst public information film ever made. So from then on, I was a big hit with all the Channel 4 comedians, you know. So yes. I'm working with, like, all of the best fringe comedians, which was great.
Well, look, Alvin, thank you very much indeed for this time that you've given me. And what I'd like to do now is I create a podcast and a special page on my website, which I'll link up to your website.
Yeah.
And obviously, at some point in the future, let's hope that we can maybe get you back on the show. It's taken me a long time to get you onto our show, you know.
All right.
I contacted your people, it must be at least 6 months ago.
All right.
And so, out of the blue, I was delighted that we'd actually got the chance to have a chat with you.
Do you know, it's probably because I've just started this. I've called it 50 Years of Rock and Roll, because it's 50 years since I got my first guitar signed. And it's now valued at £1 million.
Wow.
And so I thought, you know, I want to do all the stuff I grew up with. So we just literally started a tour. So we've got a press girl on the tour. Normally, I try and avoid interviews and things like that, but so she's getting me doing interviews again to promote the tour. So we're doing like an hour of 50s rock and roll and blues, and then an hour of like 70s and 80s
yeah,
rock, you know. So that's probably why you got through to us this time, because there's a press girl on it.
And I do hope that you've enjoyed your time with me.
It's been brilliant.
It's been really lovely to think of all the old times, and thank you very much for all that.
Where are you actually based?
Well, we're not too far from Benidorm. We're a lovely little town called Altea.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And we're sort of, well, should we say 7 kilometres going towards Valencia down the coast.
Yeah, I know it very well. I used to live in Barcelona for a while, and with Shane Fenton and the Rock and Roll Trio, we used to do a lot of the Fiesta Mayors up in the Pueblos, in the mountains.
Fantastic.
And that, you know.
Well, of course, that doesn't come up on the website, so that's a lovely link for us.
Yeah.
Well, that's a week. Well, who knows? You might even come over to here.
That'd be fantastic. I'd love to come over and work there. I love Spain. It's great.
We've got a contact now, so who knows?
Yeah.
Alvin, thank you very much indeed for all your time.
Thank you. All the very best.
Cheers. Bye-bye.
Okay, adios.
Bye-bye. Adios. Alvin Stardust, then. I've got a very, very special dedication that I'm going to make now. And it's Barbara Ann's big birthday today. I'm not going to tell you how many years, but there is...